Good morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on Newsstand Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. From Charlottesville to Harrisonburg, Lexington, Richmond on 103.1 in Richmond. Thank you so much for tuning in to WNRN and the Wake Up Call. And a special thanks for the support from last week's fun drive. Thank you so much. Your love is felt deep. And I say that with all honesty. Thank you so much for being here with us by phone and ear and wallet last week. Our guest today, Scott Harrop. He's from the University of Virginia and Middle Eastern Cultures Department. Scott, what's the official title for that department?
The Department of Middle Eastern Languages and Cultures. Middle Eastern and South Asian Languages and Cultures.
Which is probably why I'll refer to it in a much fewer words department.
Sure.
But Scott has been talking, lecturing about Middle Eastern cultures, events, uprisings, I think was the word you used, for several years now.
Indeed. I've been fortunate to be teaching courses focused on Middle Eastern uprisings for the past five semesters, and it's been quite a ride.
And that's what we'll be talking about today, some of the recent uprisings, the embassy violence, free speech, and some of the discussions that have been had around the world, a global conversation about free speech and what some consider the Western theory on free speech, and what some of the other countries, the Middle Eastern countries, have discussed as what should be appropriate free speech throughout the hour. Please write down the phone number so that you have it ready when you'd like to participate with a question or a comment for Scott Harrop today during our hour. 979-0919. And 877-WNRN-ROCKS if you're not in the Charlottesville area. All right, Scott, let's jump right to it. The reason that I called and emailed to have you on the program, because of the YouTube video that went out. So many people talking about that and blamed that for the uprisings that took place leading to the deaths with an S. I feel like some people often forget that there was more than one death in the Libyan embassy, U.S. embassy. Why did we get such different reactions from that video? The United States, many, and I don't know a percentage, but certainly not 100% if you read the comments on all the articles, but many Americans were upset by it, embarrassed by it, and many Muslims had a reaction towards violence. Why do we get the two different reactions? What do the cultures make that lead to those two different reactions?
It's an excellent question. And to begin to unpack this and to think about it, I would suggest a stepping back a little bit. First of all, you're quite right that the film itself, if you've seen the clips of it, it's quite a caricature and extremely low budget. Even the actors and actresses had words put in their mouths, and in some ways, it's almost laughable. On the other hand, it was a film clearly designed to incite anger. It pushed all the wrong buttons. It focused on some of the most sensitive, horrendous things that one could do if one wanted to insult the prophet of the faith of a quarter of the world's population. On the other hand, and it is true that there were a number of angry, loud protests that did occur around the Middle East. The size of them, though, has been remarkable in the sense that they petered out rather quickly. But yes, there was that instant negative reaction. And here in the United States, there's this sense of why are they getting upset about this? We have to learn to tolerate speech and things we don't like. On the other hand, it's widely known across the Islamic world that in the United States, there's often some severe negative caricatures of their faith. So it's perceived as this intense cultural onslaught on their faith, if you will. But I would come back to that point, and we can go into this in greater detail, that yes, there was these initial expressions of outrage, and they were often focused on American embassies, and that's part of what President Obama was so quick to attempt to defuse some of that, to say that this was not an American film, nothing we support, and that was even before the tragic events that led to the death of our ambassador at the Benghazi consulate.
But still, for many people, you know, and we'll get into a more specific free speech discussion throughout a little later in the hour. But Americans, and again, I understand that I'm going to stereotype and I am going to bring forth a percentage of people who may not fall into the category that I'm discussing, so I'm going to choose my words as best I can, but many Americans were upset by the video because they felt as though it represented them when it did not.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. In fact, some of the harshest criticisms of the film, and then some of the extremely, and I don't even want to use the word conservative because it's insulting to the word conservative, but some of the most incendiary pastors who were supporting it, I've seen some of the strongest condemnations of them coming from evangelical voices, conservative Christians who are saying we should not be in the business of insulting someone else's faith. On the other hand, there are some voices out there that are very much, when they see the rage, or at least the perceived rage coming from the Islamic side, then they will be quick to use that as examples of, see, they're not capable of democracy, see that they're driven by rage, they're not capable of being good friends and allies of the United States, and we would have been better off keeping dictators. And this becomes a terrible, if you will, mutually reinforcing negative cycle among, if you will, hotheads on both sides.
And yes, mutually reinforcing cycle, because there are, and I'd love to hear a little later in the hour when we open up the phone lines from people who feel that I'm misrepresenting this, but we have a fair number of Americans who are embarrassed by the video, who don't feel that it represents us as a culture and as a nation, but then can turn around and say, why is that your reaction? Why is the Muslim reaction take you to violence? Because I'm trying to say we're sorry and please don't let it upset you too much. And yet you let it upset you so much that you do something that is, if not equally wrong, at, you know, possibly even more so, because instead of being upset, you've let yourself be upset to violence rather than just upset to words.
And indeed, I've heard a similar criticism being offered by Muslim thinkers, Muslim scholars, Muslim religious leaders, in effect to fellow Muslims, saying, in effect, let's follow the example of the Prophet. Let's not allow ourselves to be baited. Let's not let them control the game. Let's, in effect, even as we would hate and resent the form of expression, nonetheless rise above it. But you're on to something. It's a fair concern. It's a fair question. I think it's just as interesting to be watching what's happening across the Muslim world. There are these voices rising up and saying we have to be better than this. And indeed, the counter demonstrations, or as a one of my favorite journalists, Robin Wright, has mentioned in one of her recent books, the so-called counter jihad, the struggle against extremism, the struggle against the turn to violence, struggling to find alternative ways to engage the West, to engage their own radicals, their own extremists within. And that, to me, is one of the most fascinating, if you will, revolutions happening in the world today, a revolution, a struggle within Islam itself. How do we engage these important ideals? And as we're about to get to, the questions about freedom of speech and expression.
11:11 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Scott Harrop from the University of Virginia, teaching in the Middle Eastern Cultures program for the time being. You go back and forth. You're also in the Department of Politics. We're opening up the phone line shortly. We are talking about current events, recent events in the Middle East. Scott, would things have been pretty much reversed, mirror image reversed, if this had been done the other way, if there had been a Muslim-produced video that made such images of Christ and therefore upset the United States to violence reaction. Do you feel that things could have been done that way, or would have had similar outcomes?
That's a very interesting.
I'm trying to think of the comic book phrase where there's the other world that is right. Sort of it's almost the mirror image.
I hear you, and that's a very interesting thought, and maybe it's more in the realm of a hypothetical. We have had lots of incendiary films and productions done about Christ, but they're generally done within Europe or even within American contexts in expressions of art that many Christians find extremely offensive. I'm not aware of that happening within the Muslim culture. I mean, I can be corrected on that. Generally speaking, what's interesting is how, and there's a long debate and discussion about this, but within different Islamic experiences, there actually is a very strong reverence towards Christ, towards Jesus, as one of the most esteemed prophets. So I don't think you would see that, and even then it might be, if you will, squelched from within their cultural experience. So it's an interesting hypothetical, but I think that most Christians, when they encounter those sorts of things, it's not being, if you will, being produced by Muslims.
But when you read, and granted, this discussion could go on for a long period of time, but when you read the comments on an article, on an online blog, on a news article for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Newsweek, which we'll get to shortly, many of the comments are incendiary about how we were mad, they killed, now we should kill.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it difficult to believe, despite my hopes, that if things were reversed, it wouldn't play out just as a reversal. It would be, we're sorry, Middle Eastern individuals, because there have been a lot of positive reactions in the Middle East, support, against the militia, against what was done, against the killing and violence. But if a Muslim country or group somehow produced a similar video, that the Americans, some would be upset, some would speak heavily against the behavior, and some people would commit violence. And then, because we committed violence first, then a Muslim country or group would therefore commit violence as well. And if you read these comments sent forth by Americans, you're just sort of, I find the tension going, please don't, please don't, please don't.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, therein is a core danger for their societies and for our own. We've had some extremely ugly incidents. I mean, we pride ourselves right here in Charlottesville, home of Mr. Jefferson, author of the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom, that seminal document that we take such great pride on in terms of religious tolerance, and yet increasingly, I see signs of a very intense building resentment towards Muslims in our midst, and that has taken some ugly turns recently. There was a burning of a mosque in Joplin, Missouri this past summer. I'm happy to note that it was actually the actions of a very, I just met her recently, her first name is Ashley. I'm forgetting her last name at the moment. But there in Joplin, she was a conservative Christian student at a Christian Bible college. And she says, wait a minute, they just burned the mosque down in our own community. This is wrong. And she organized, literally, on her own initiative, a love rally trying to figure out, okay, we got differences. We have different faiths, but we're also Americans. We have common grounds of faith, common grounds of history, things that we can work on together. In fact, even today in Joplin, they're having a day of service in which Christians and Muslims are working together side by side. So I'm with you in sensing the danger, the spiral getting out of control. But on the other hand, I'm seeing that there are people trying to figure out ways. Now, we can build some bridges here. We do have some things that we can, if you will, lance this festering boil.
11:16 on the wake-up call as we talk with our guest today, Scott Harrop, from the University of Virginia, and we're discussing Middle Eastern current events. Let me take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support at WNRN. You can find Blue Ridge Graphics at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville. They provide custom t-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics. It's 434-296-9746. Online, BRG T-shirts. www.thewakeupcall.com. Scott, we talk about, you know, the violence. I'm sort of trying to feel more about that and the concern for it. But the violence, I lost my count, but it's two digits. I mean, it's 10, 12, two dozen numbers of countries where violence was the follow-up to this YouTube film. I find that to be
concerning,
the number of each country that has a violent reaction to the film just breeds one more person, one more group on the American side, one step further in that sort of violent reaction to that.
Let me try to offer some different angles on trying to get a handle on this. I mean, yes, we have over a quarter billion Muslims a billion Muslims in the world, spread across dozens of countries. We're not seeing entire countries enraged. They may be angry about it or furious about it, but the numbers of people actually taking up violence, engaged in violent actions. In fact, we're still waiting on the actual intelligence about what happened in Benghazi, suggestion being that the actions might actually have been by a group that took advantage of this event to carry out events on 9/11 they were going to do anyway. We don't know on that for sure, but I would urge some caution about that we not over dramatize the extent of the violence in the reaction. Yes, there's widespread displeasure about the film, but is it necessarily manifesting itself in terms of violence? I would suggest not. In fact, one of the things that's remarkable in that infamous Newsweek cover story about Muslim rage, which was trying to pull out in effect all the push buttons, in effect saying, "See, this proves that Muslims are really a radical, rage-filled people, and that their hatred is towards our freedoms." What was fascinating is that even underneath that blog, hundreds of Muslims around the world started taking pictures of themselves engaged in ordinary, everyday activities, taking their children swinging, playing kickball or soccer, and in fact, say, "This is an example of me in rage." I think I know what you're getting at, but overall, I think it's fair to say that there's been something other than violence being expressed. Displeasure, perhaps, widespread, but is it necessarily manifesting itself in terms of violence? I think not. In fact, I think what's remarkable is the size of the rallies, the counter-rallies against the violence, particularly in Libya, that is remarkable and worth following. I mean, Ambassador Chris Stevens, and I may have worked with him back when he was on the Iran desk years ago, but from all accounts that I've heard about him, he is someone who was deeply committed to assisting the Libyan people, helping them find their own way. Yes, he was one of America's best ambassadors, and yes, he was apparently in Benghazi. He was about to open up, an American space, a center for Libyans to come and understand more about American culture. But he was fluent in Arabic, and my understanding is that he is someone who was widely appreciated in Libya. And in fact, if you've seen the pictures of tens of thousands of people showing up at rallies trying to express their sorrow over his death and trying to say that the anger, the violence that was directed against that consulate did not speak for Libyans as a whole. Even as Libya has lots of problems, they've got lots of issues, I think I'm more impressed by the size of the counter demonstrations, particularly in Libya.
11:20 here on the Wake Up Call with Scott Harrop as we talk about Middle Eastern current events. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, high in the low 70s, a little cooler in the valley. Partly cloudy with fog overnight, lows 50 to 55. And then tomorrow, sunny in the morning, 30% chance of rain in the afternoon. Highs 70 to 75, still cooler in the valley and in Lynchburg. Beautiful day outside now, 61 in Lynchburg, 61 in the valley, 66 in Richmond, 60 here in Charlottesville. Back here with Scott Harrop talking about Middle Eastern current events. Scott, we were talking about the rally that took place in Benghazi, almost sort of the opposite of what Newsweek called Muslim rage. Did that get less notice in the United States than it possibly should have?
to be honest, I was focused more on covering the media and the press in the Middle East and wasn't quite as much paying attention to the American media. That's what I've generally picked up, is that observers were disappointed that American news media... think about it, though. You know how the American news cycle works. Anger, violence, that gets headlines. But people are doing a rally, in effect, trying to, in effect, say, we love America, or we appreciated Ambassador Stevens's service, and that's not going to get as much... It doesn't make quite as much of a headline, except that it should have, because it was counter to that widespread expectation. Well, here's this film. It's obviously... we're embarrassed by it. It's so deeply insulting to their revered prophet, so we're expecting rage, and guess what? Maybe they are expressing their displeasure in ways something other than violence. I think one of the fascinating things that's happening all across the Arab world, and even indeed the Islamic world, is there is this, in effect, saying we're not going to allow our revolutions to be hijacked by this. If you will, consider the possibility that actions like this, the violence, is by those who are trying to provoke chaos. And they have, if you will, a vested interest in promoting chaos, because they, in effect, would like to take advantage of these ongoing uprisings, these evolving revolutions, to try and skew things in towards their favor. And that's an interesting possibility. We go back to the Iranian Revolution in 1978-79, and as it evolved into the early 1980s, and that was a broad-based revolution, many different factions supporting that revolution, and a lot of unpredictable events that we couldn't have seen in advance happened along the way. The hostage crisis, Iraq invades Iran, the failed rescue attempt, a whole series of events that, if you will, you can make the case helped, if you will, hijack that revolution, go in directions that it might not have happened in time. But it was often in response to chaos or in response to violence, and it allowed, if you will, hardliners to grip the reins of the revolution and move it in directions favorable to them. So, but I would suggest that what's happening today in Libya, perhaps even in Egypt, is you have relatively moderate voices saying we're not going to allow our revolution to be hijacked by radical events like this, or by, if you will, events happening in America. We're going to control this. We're not going to let our reaction to that cause our revolution to harm itself.
If you'd like to participate in today's discussion with Scott Harrop, please call us up, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's toll-free. Again, 979-0919 and 877-WNRN-ROCKS. We're here today with the support of your Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield authorized agent, Herb Bennett. As your local agent in Central Virginia, Herb provides expert knowledge and personal service in designing your individual health insurance plan. Your health is worth protecting, and you shouldn't let it go uninsured. For a quote, you can give Agent Herb Bennett a call, 855-425-0090, or you can visit online, agentherb.com. Scott, one of the things, you know, the Muslim Rage article in Newsweek, as you talked about, pushing all the buttons, sort of, and the response to that from many people was, it was mocked. But again, is there an American rage for the reactions that did or did not happen? Because there was a lot of reaction from some, whether they're individuals in our community, or whether they have some sort of leadership throughout our country, that were upset that President Obama's reaction was nonviolent, that his reaction was to talk about, to say, all right, everybody, let's calm down and talk this through. So for those who were unhappy with that, is their reaction some form of American rage?
That's a good and interesting point. And I don't want to come across as too partisan here, but there's a series of flashpoints. We are in the midst of our own political season, and it's perhaps natural that there's always going to be people looking for weaknesses in what the leader of our country says in response to an emerging crisis. And part of it was that Obama's comments before the ambassador was killed were then taken as somehow apologizing for, or somehow trying to make excuses for that. I think it's fairly clear from the record that after the killing of the ambassador, the president was quite firm in condemning that. On the other hand, there's a lot of people in effect saying, well, doesn't this mean that we should be cutting off all of our aid to these countries? Doesn't it mean that we should be going in there, that we should be having drones doing strikes inside Libya? Doesn't it mean that we should be getting tough with these countries to show them that we're expecting that if we're not sure they're even allies anymore, we need to, in effect, tell them what they have to do if they want to still be our good allies? And I understand that. Maybe it's rage. I don't want to necessarily demean that approach, but I understand those perspectives, those concerns. But I would suggest that one of the interesting things about these revolutions, about these uprisings all across the Middle East, if there's two things to really comprehend about what's happening, is it's an expression of the dignity of these people. For decades, if not a century, they've lived under dictatorships that they often perceived as somehow continuing in power, if you will, with the cooperation, if not the outright connivance of external powers or external hidden hands keeping these dictators in control over them. Finally, you have these people, for a variety of reasons, in effect saying, no, we're going to pick our own path. It's an expression of our dignity, and yes, even like the American Revolution, an expression of their independence. So when you have, for example, the president of Egypt, who's a remarkable and surprising character, President Morsi, showing up at the United Nations, giving a long interview to the New York Times and to other sources, where if I can take away one thing about what President Morsi was saying, his message to America was, okay, we're willing to work with you, but we're going to work as equals here. And if you can work with us as equals, there's a series of common interests we have, appealing to President Obama's early rhetoric about mutual interests and mutual respect. But you have to be able to treat us as an equal. You're not necessarily going to be able to dictate everything that we do. And we've got a series of difficult issues to work through here. But I think that's what's remarkable about all of these revolutions, is there's expressions of dignity, of independence, and yes, struggles for freedom within these countries. And the one thing that we can't be doing is engaged in heavy-handed actions. For example, this whole issue of drone strikes and aerial bombardments. Libya was the first country in the world history that was ever bombed. People forget about this. The Italians did it in the early colonial history. So the issue of bombing from external powers has a special significance in Libya. That little historical footnote aside, there is this, are these countries simply to be dictated to, or do we wish them well? Do we wish their relatively moderate forces in these countries, do we wish to appeal to them according to our values and our interests and then live according to them, or do we just simply want to use our force and beat them around the head with a stick?
Well, let's talk about Egyptian President Morsi, because this is where, to me, the free speech conversation begins. At the recent United Nations gathering, President Obama stands up, and a significant part of his speech is how everyone needs to learn that the acceptance of Western free speech is the right way. And in fact, in some ways, because of modern technology, it's the only way that can happen now. And then Egyptian President Morsi stands up, and I think he's preceded by or followed by the president of Yemen, who both pretty much say the same thing, which is free speech is fine. In fact, we've come to the part where free speech is good. We understand how it helps in many ways. But, let's see if I can find the quotes here. Egypt respects freedom of expression, one that is not used to incite hatred against anyone, one that is not directed toward one specific religion or cult. And from the Yemen president, there should be limits for freedom of expression, especially if such freedom blasphemies the beliefs of nations and defames their figures. I think for many Americans, at least what we are taught as we go through school, is that, well, that is freedom of freedom of speech. What else is freedom of speech for, except to make negative comments towards government, other groups, and the leaders of them? And so if Egypt represents much of Middle East and their thoughts on freedom of speech, there is no freedom of speech. How do you define the two types, the Western and, are we calling it the other, the Eastern, the, whatever title it gets?
I really appreciate your question, and you've obviously done some homework, and I appreciate that you're aware of these important speeches by new leaders. I have interject a thought here. One of my former professors here at the university, Ennis Claude, one of my favorite professors, used to, in a great book he did on the United Nations, would often characterize the UN General Assembly debates as a grand wind tunnel of hot air. Or that's what critics would think. But in this case, and I know that may sound funny, but Professor Claude actually was countering that because it's an important wind tunnel. Because here, in that Jeffersonian sense, in the Declaration, you have various nations, and in this case, new leaders having a decent respect to the opinions of mankind. They're coming to the UN, they're speaking before that candid world, again using phrases from our own Declaration of Independence, because just like the United States, we're actively saying, okay, we're not just telling you what we think, we have things that it's our statement of what's important to us, our statement of problems in the world, our vision of where we think what the world needs to work for. And these debates, just this past week, and I'm so glad you focused on that, these debates, these statements, indeed did represent what may seem to be clashing perspectives on what to us here in the United States is such a fundamental right, the right of free expression. And again, you know, I've been teaching my courses through it, and I'm serious when I say this, teaching these courses on revolutions in the Middle East through a Jeffersonian prism here at the University of Virginia, the place that he founded. And I find it perfectly natural. And the more we get into it, each issue that comes up, I keep thinking, oh, well, Mr. Jefferson would speak to that too. And of course, we have former President O'Neill from the university with his own center on there's a lot of important debates here. But let me just offer a couple of very narrow thoughts on this. First of all, President Obama in his address, which is very important, and I would urge listeners to read it or listen to it. He makes an interesting argument for the importance of free speech. He's not trying to defend the film, but he's trying to say to the world, and he's also trying to say to his constituencies here in the United States, that yes, I'm standing behind American values, and this is important to us, and we're not backing down from that. He actually made a rather practical argument. It's because, as you mentioned, because of modern technologies, that we can't stop these things from being produced or disseminated into the international airwaves or to the internet. But it was kind of a practical, less than satisfying argument for free speech. No doubt other expositors and thinkers about free speech, Jeffersonians, if you will, are going to be continuing to debate just what that meant. Even with Jefferson himself, it wasn't simply a fully absolute right. And we have all kinds of classic cases in American constitutional jurisprudence as to just, do we really mean absolute free speech? The classic question about yelling fire in a theater. Or also the issues of hate speech. We now here in the United States have things called hate crimes. And what does hate crime include when you have someone issuing such incendiary, hateful speech that it causes someone to engage in actions that then result in what we would prosecute as a hate crime? So that to me there's a lot of interesting debate here, and perhaps even room for future conferences, future activities, and maybe here at Monticello to begin to discuss just what do we mean by free speech as a universal right, both for here in the United States as well as for these countries that are struggling with new freedoms, new democracies, trying to figure out what that means. And that would apply not just to this right of free speech, which we do consider so central to our democratic experience, but also to freedoms such as freedom of religion, freedom of the press. There's so many issues that we have a lot to talk about, and I don't have any easy answers on that one.
But is there a free speech or freedom of speech as could exist through the eyes of the president of Egypt? If what he and the Yemen president refer to as, if such freedom blasphemies the beliefs of nations and defames their figures, for the United States, what else is free speech used for? And I understand that we can pick, you know, pieces out of that question. But that is what it exists for in the United States, correct?
I'm not quite sure I'm following you, but
For freedom of speech in the United States, I think if you asked someone, if you walked up and down the downtown mall, like the Hook often does, and says, you know, define freedom of speech, I think a very large percentage of people would define it as the opportunity to speak negatively against your nation or your leadership. And here we have the Yemen president saying freedom of speech is okay, except if used that way. Well, what freedom of speech is left in Egypt or Yemen if it's defined by them in that manner?
Indeed, that's the classic slippery slope. What's the question? Here at the University of Virginia, one of the often presumed motto of the university, and I've often had it on my syllabi, is a part of it is here we're not afraid to tolerate error so long as reason is free to combat it. And if that's the ultimate, okay, somebody may say something, may find it so terribly offensive, it may be grotesquely in error, but let's talk about it. Let's reason about it. Let's get it out in the open rather than suppress it and not to be even heard. That very much is our heritage. That is our aspiration, even as we don't oftentimes we don't live up to it. And you're quite right. If you have countries in the Middle East, even as they're struggling in these new revolutionary societies, and they start making exceptions, well, then does one exception lead to another one? Defaming the prophet. What about defaming the leader of the society? The country I follow the closest, Iran, just in the past couple of days has had a series of extraordinary. Even while you have the president of Iran here in this country, one of his key allies was arrested and put into jail. There was another newspaper that got one of their cartoonists got arrested because his cartoon was perceived as mocking the sacrifices of soldiers who had served in the Iran-Iraq War. Obviously, they've got some serious problems they have to work there, and we would recognize that as problematic, and Iranian liberal reformers would recognize it as something that they have to get away from, that they have to learn to be able to tolerate speech, to tolerate those things that are critical, even if things they hold sacred. But I do understand that on issues of faith, on issues of, if you will, sacred things, there are indeed sharply different perspectives around the world, even within democracies, and they would still insist, we're still democracies, but we still reserve the right to protect certain sanctities within our system and would, in effect, still call it democracy, as they would find the path in their appropriate to their culture, they would say.
11:38 here on WNRN Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. We're here thanks to you and the pledges that we have received over the years, and especially this last week. Our guest today, Scott Harrop from the University of Virginia, as we talk about Middle Eastern events of the last few weeks.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Market Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on newsstands Thursday. Here's Rick on what you can find on this week's Hook.
And back in June, many members of UVA's Board of Visitors made it clear they didn't think Teresa Sullivan was up to the job. But who would they have preferred? The Hook takes a look at some of those contenders. And who are these Board of Visitor members? And how much money do they give to the school or to their governor of choice? Plus, Yeardley Love's mother and sister speak publicly for the first time. The Hook, also thanking you for supporting WNRN. And we thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, celebrating 40 years as your local one-stop source for outdoor gear, apparel, and footwear. Fall apparel now landing at Blue Ridge. You can get ready for the autumn air with lightweight fleece jackets from Patagonia and the North Face. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road in Charlottesville and at two locations in Richmond. For more information, it's brms.com. You're welcome to call with your question or comment, 979-0919-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Lecturer Scott Harrop here from the University of Virginia. Scott, one of the things that caught my attention most is the President Morsi and others talking about free speech had asked the United Nations Council to consider international action to crack down on speech that defames religions. What happens in the United States if UN Council accepts that request, and so therefore the Western style of free speech is no longer allowed globally?
That's an interesting question. I've heard versions of that where I think there's some sheriff out in Arizona who's trying to raise taxes in his county because he's concerned that the United States is somehow going to surrender its sovereignty to the UN. I forget just what the issue was on his case, and that we might be sending. Interesting speculation, but to my understanding, the United States is not about to be surrendering its sovereignty over those delegates, especially not something like freedom of expression.
But how many countries belong to the UN?
Oh,
200 plus?
I'm not sure the exact number. Yeah, it's been expanding dramatically since, of course, the collapse of the old Soviet Union.
So if the vote were to take place and the majority were to choose President Morsi's method of free speech, which is, okay, you have free speech, but you can't talk about other religions.
Okay.
And so the United States says, now you're in the minority. What happens? The UN Council, which theoretically leads...
Oh, I follow you now. Well, first of all, that would be at the level of the UN General Assembly. And even if there was such a resolution, which I have trouble imagine seeing that coming. But even if it would, resolutions from the UN General Assembly don't rise to the level of, if you will, enforceable international law. And even if the UN Security... The international law that would matter would be expressions of resolutions at the UN Security Council. And at that place, the United States, Britain, France would all likely veto such a resolution. So I just don't see it happening.
All right. We have a call from Newt. Hey, good morning, Newt.
Good morning.
Question or comment?
Yeah, I had a question for the professor there regarding Iran. My question is, I've heard about there's this organization in Iran called the MEK, and supposedly they're like an insurgent group. And I was wondering if he thought that maybe they might come to the forefront in Iran if they were to have a revolution like they had in Syria or in Egypt. And the other question is, I've heard that there is indication that Israel has been supporting this organization as maybe an alternative to a strike, like maybe they just like to change the regime. And also what the influence of Iranian Americans in the MEK, because my understanding is that they do a lot of support for the MEK in Iran. So just basically, you know, what all the significance is of this MEK, because I heard it just got taken off the list of terrorist organizations in the United States.
All right. Thanks, Newt. I'm going to let the professor take those questions. Thanks.
Thank you.
Newt, thanks for the call, and that is an important question. It's actually a subject I've followed very closely since the mid-1990s. It happens I was one of the outside consultants on the original State Department report that led to their listing on the terrorism report in the first place, and the caller, Newt, is correct that as of yesterday, at least it's now been admitted that it's going forward on legal grounds to delist them from the terrorist the designated terrorist organizations. Have some colleagues that have been working on this issue, but as I understand it, the argument was made on narrow legal grounds, saying that, well, over the past decade, they haven't been involved in what we specifically define as terrorist actions. And that's an interesting, complicated argument. I'm also aware, though, that it's believed by some sources that they were being used by the Israelis or by other sources in the recent killings of Iranian nuclear scientists, which would potentially rise to the level of them deserving to be on that terrorism list. Unfortunately, that terrorism list has been quite politicized for decades, and I don't want to get lost in the legal issues. But to your broader question, to what extent would they possibly be a useful, if you will, pressure point against the Iranians? And here, now this is my opinion, but I would suggest that it's widely held, even among observers who have no love for the particular regime itself. But to keep it very short, a complicated, long argument, they would point out that, yes, they were one of the groups part of the original revolution. They split apart from the revolution early in the 1980s. But to my understanding, my experience in traveling around Iran, you almost never encounter, even when you get to know people, again, people who have no particular appreciation for that system over there, when the subject of the People's Mujahideen of Iran comes up, or the Mujahideen-e Khalq, there is widespread resentment, widespread concern. The United States knows what they are, don't they? During the Iran-Iraq War, they were based in Iraq. They often did the dirty work on behalf of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. It's often referred to as an Islamic Marxist group, or some refer to it as a cult. This was a brutal revolutionary or a military organization. with precious little, in my understanding, again, this is my opinion, precious little support inside Iran. The fact that we would be supporting them or external be supporting them is actually a gift to the current system in Iran, in effect, because if it's perceived that somehow the United States is backing this organization, in my understanding, it would redound incredibly negatively inside Iran. I'm aware I've had some students who have a more optimistic view of the organization, but my sense is that and even among conservative neoconservatives in Washington, such as Daniel Pletka at the American Enterprise Institute, and there is widespread sense of you. And this is one case where the enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend, and supporting them is who knows what they actually stand for, and then secondly, they would be counterproductive in terms of support inside Iran. That said, there have been a lot of prominent politicians in the United States, both Republicans and Democrats, both parties, who were accepting huge speaking fees on behalf of that organization and led to that lobbying effort, which recently got them off the terrorism list. Sorry for the long answer, but that is a very delicate and yet important question. Thank you for it.
All right, Newt, thanks for the call. If anyone else has a call you'd like to make for a comment or a question, 979-0919, 877-WNRN Rock. Scott Harrop from the Department of Middle Eastern Cultures. I know that's not the full title, or Department of Politics here at the University of Virginia, as we talk about Middle East current events. Call us up. Let me thank Dixon Disposal for their support at WNRN. They are family-owned and operated for 40 years now. Dixon Disposal works to promote green awareness. Dixon offers all-in-one can recycling, so you won't have to spend time sorting or trying to figure out if your items are recyclable. These recyclable items won't end up in the landfill. For more information on the all-in-one can recycling, it's DixonDisposal.com or call them, 978-2111. And now that it's 11:48, Drew Thompson just walking in the room. He'll be here at noon for Les Temps Perdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative music. Take a trip back to the times gone by with Les Temps Perdue, only on WNRN. All right, Scott, I'm curious as to, you know, we talked about free speech a little bit in Middle East in comparison to the Western theory. We talked about the YouTube video and sort of how that played out and the after effects of that. But how has that changed relationships between the United States and other countries? Are there specific countries that we can talk about in terms of plus or minus in terms of the relationship factor?
It's an interesting question. I think we're at an interesting everything is interesting here, but we're at a crossroads. We're at a crossroads where we have countries that are having recently thrown off long, brutal authoritarian regimes. And yes, some of them continue to receive substantial amounts of American aid, which they want to continue coming. They've got various interests in maintaining good relations with the United States. And yet at the same time, the platforms, the ideologies, the values of these peoples are coming forward. They no longer have, if you will, authoritarian regimes keeping those long repressed values and aspirations of the people or wide swaths of the population at bay. And, for example, the issue of Israel and Palestine and the long festering conflict there. Yes, I understand that a lot of Americans are very concerned about what Egypt's position will be on that going forward. And President Morsi made quite clear that, well, yes, we want to continue to be our alliance with the United States. And yes, you're looking for us to continue certain things. And we're looking to you to live up to your side of the original treaty. Let's see you get serious about that peace process. So there's, President Obama, in an unguarded moment, when he was asked, well, is Egypt still our ally? He said, in effect, I'm not sure. That's an interesting way to approach a country that you're giving billions of dollars of aid to. And of course, a lot of people or critics of Egypt are saying, well, of course they're not our allies. But on the other hand, do you simply want to dismiss them and write off a very important relationship? Do you want to automatically assume that they're an enemy and start treating them as an enemy?
But it's an important relationship in a variety of ways that's often overlooked. It's not just political because of their location and their authority in the Middle East, but you hear people saying, let's write them off, start sending them money, and then how much are you paying for your gallon of gas tomorrow? And it doesn't stop there, but sort of the president and our leadership is asked to always look one step ahead or even more. And many people, including myself, look at the immediate factor and say, well, just do this. And I'm not sure that, and I'm looking for the academic response to the changes in relationships and how that may play. What has happened within the last 2 weeks, and why is that important over the next 2 decades? So we seem to be talking about Egypt, and the president says, I'm not sure. Why does he say that? And what does that answer mean to President Morsi?
It was potentially very insulting to an Egyptian, in fact, saying, are you not granting us, can we still be friends, and yet can you still grant us the freedom to assert our values and perspectives on
things?
Are
you welcome in my house? I don't know.
that's a good point, and I appreciate the observations that you've just offered. A lot of people are looking at this, in effect, saying, is the Arab Spring over? I've seen a lot of these phrases, Arab fall or Arab winter's upon us. I would encourage listeners to look at the recent op-ed by the Tunisian president in the New York Times, where he, in effect, is saying, oh, no, the Arab Spring is still flowering, and you need to, yes, we will have our small fringes that will go to the violence, that will want to promote the chaos, will want to take everything off track. But on the other hand, he's saying that ultimately it is in America's interest to see the democracy project continue to flourish, to continue to survive, that it's something you should wish well rather than wish to hold back. That said, I don't want to sound like I'm an automatic Pollyanna here. I'm aware of a series of dangerous flashpoints, problems of sectarianism, deep tribal rule. We don't know where these things are going. We don't know for sure that they're all going to turn out so well. But on the other hand, we're not in a position to control them either. Whoever the president is come next January, he's going to have to be facing the same questions. We'll have American values on free speech and freedom of religion, but we'll also have these other great strategic interests, our friendship with Israel, our interest in oil, that will continue to present any future president with a series of conflicting interests that have to be worked through carefully.
Do you envision, and I realize that in some ways you, I don't ask this as you representing the University of Virginia, but with your academic background, do you believe that with the information that we have in terms of skill set and comments made, that our two presidential candidates would take us far apart? Because many people say that, oh, we only have two political parties, and really, on most things, they're really, you know, doing the same thing, except one person putting the right foot forward first instead of the left, but it's the same path. Do you see either candidate drifting too far from where we might be headed now if one is elected over the other?
That's a great question, and I immediately offer some self-caution. I have great concerns about both candidates. I've been following Yemen and Pakistan matters very closely, and I personally am very concerned about our over-reliance on drones and potential serious blowback that's developing there. And that's a criticism more at the current administration. I think they're beginning to realize they've got some serious problems there, and there's a lot of pushback coming from prominent law school organizations that are documenting the serious problems with that issue. There is this, well, you brought up University of Virginia as an educational institution. And I don't want to seem like I'm passing on our presidential candidates, but in the time we have left, at least I should offer, what is it that the United States can do, if you will, to most positively support these ongoing uprisings, these revolutions, as they're trying to find their way? I've already been hinting and suggesting the one thing we can't be doing is we're not in a position to be telling them how they should be resolving these issues. Now, yes, of course, we have certain, things that we'll insist upon, like that our ambassadors be protected, that we would hope for positive relationship, we would hope for open trade, we would hope for values to be, that democracy would take root and flourish, and that we'd have good relationships, but we're not in a position to control them. And in fact, I would suggest that the more we try to control them, the less likely it is that they're going to turn out in ways that are favorable to us. The Syria case right now is, we haven't talked about that and we don't really have time right now, but the Syrian case, there's all kinds of competing nightmares in their ways, in terms of which ways to go. There are no simple answers with Syria having, and we're in an awful position. But long term, with the Arab uprisings in particular, the one thing that the University of Virginia and other institutions, but especially the University of Virginia, given its founding purposes to be educated future civil servants, educated, knowledgeable citizens, to have a functioning democracy. There is a core, even in those old ideals of Jefferson in founding the University of Virginia, therein is the seed of the best approach, and my own mentor, Professor Ramazzani, has made similar arguments about this recently, that indeed that's the one thing that the United States can be truly offering that would be constructive. That is, he's used the phrase, an education Marshall Plan for the entire region to help these societies as they begin to grapple with what does it mean to be the democracy. These are not overnight questions. This struggle is going to be with us for quite some time. I wish I could say that it's all going to turn out great by January. My sense is that these struggles, we're going to be watching it for quite some time.
And let me take that moment to thank Professor Ramazzani. He's been a guest on the program multiple times now, and I wish him and his family the best, and thank him for hooking us up so that Scott Harrop could join us today. 11:57 here on the Wake Up Call. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. And it's the support of businesses like L. Oppelman's, Central Virginia's complete music headquarters, continuously operated since 1890 at 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg. L. Oppelman's music department, now featuring acoustic guitars, mandolins, banjos, as well as electric guitar packages and complete drum sets. That's L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street in Lynchburg, and at loppelman.com. Scott, one last thing, just a minute or so left, but to tie the YouTube video together with free speech, you mentioned it as possibly being about hate crime, and we sort of drifted into that topic a little bit. Do you think that the makers of that video/film will be prosecuted for a hate crime? Because I think in almost a direct pattern can be led to the death of an American ambassador.
Now, that's even more interesting. I was raising that as it just kind of occurred to me in our point of our conversation. I think the producer of that film is more in trouble on other grounds. Apparently, he was just arrested recently for violating probation on something. But I think Americans are rightly proud of our traditions of freedom of expression, the right to permit the most heinous things to be produced. And even though we may find them so reprehensible, to still defend your right to produce it, to say it. But on the other hand, it's not an absolute situation, and we do have a recognition that there are some things that we need to be very cautious about. But I think we're going to be very careful with this one. Even as we insist that the government, the country, the American people as a whole, we don't stand for this sort of thing. On the other hand, what we do stand for is the right of our citizens to say things that we may find incredibly objectionable. But on the other hand, there's a certain amount of humbleness that we have to recognize that even as we'd like to think this is a universal right, that it's inalienable in a Jeffersonian sense, we're not there yet. There are a lot of cultural disagreements.
Scott, thank you so much for being our guest today. There's no way we could get anywhere close to finishing this topic or discussion. Scott Harrop from the University of Virginia, as we finish up talking about Middle Eastern current events, SevillePodcast.com. You can go online and check that out. Next week, Dean of the Curry School at the University, Bob Pianta, here as we talk about some studies that were done in how to teach kids and how teachers can be their best. Thank you so much. See you next week.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news. On newsstands Thursday, the wake-up call is also supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.